Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Early Monday morning rise on the West Coast with the rain. Kind of feel like it's a Seattle setting. Story for another day. My meteorologist friend, Kirk Hawkins of KTLA Channel 5. We'll have to talk to him about that. But this is the show that picks up steam each and every week. And 347-205-9631 can get you to the forefront. Anything after that, 30 minutes, goes by quick. We realize that. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms. Wherever you subscribe to the podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, as I lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, my guest, boy, he's written 10 books. Unbelievable guy out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Ronald P. Waldo. Ronald, first of all, how are you today?
Doing good, Mark. I appreciate you inviting me on the show to talk about my book and some other things relative to sports.
Yeah, Pittsburgh, God's country. The other thing is, how can people get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you, which I think they'll get a hold of you?
As far as the current book, my current book is titled Days of Reckoning, Players Punching Their Ticket Out of Pittsburgh During the Barney Dreyfuss Era, and it pretty much is self-explanatory from the title. It basically covers players from when Dreyfuss owned the Pirates from 1900 to 1932 who for some reason or another fell out of favor with management and usually find themselves playing in a new baseball home. And that book is through Sunbury Press Books, and you can get that on their website, which is www.sunbury, that's S-U-N-B-U-R-Y, press.com. And that book was released in October.
Yeah. Blessed enough with all these books and stacking them up, man. I'll feel like I'm part of the Pittsburgh lore of sports. And, you know, you bring up an interesting thing with talking about Pittsburgh sports. And we have talked numerous times, and we could always go back to, I think it was in the 80s, the Pirates had those successful decades in the, you know, 60s, 70s, and we got into the 80s, and it was, you know, kind of a dark cloud hanging over the city, the Cocaine Seven, the mascot, the players rumored to be, you know, involved with drug dealing, and then the Pirates threatened to move out of Pittsburgh. And I said to myself, how the hell do you move a team out of Pittsburgh that's been there over 100 years? I think the only oldest franchise in the National League, if I'm not mistaken, is the Cincinnati Reds. So the Pirates back then were rumored to move to New Orleans or Colorado, because Colorado didn't have the Rockies at the time. They had the hockey team called the Colorado Rockies. But how crazy was that to have the Pirates? And this is the big problem we're facing with the Oakland A's now. I mean, if you're a commissioner, and I'm not a big fan of Rob Manfred, and I've made that well known, but if you're a commissioner of a league, how do you take teams out of a city that's been there six, seven, eight decades and decide that, well, I got, you know, unlimited resources from inheritance funds, I'm just going to carpet bag the team to another city? There should be some kind of thing in place here, Ronald, to keep that team in that city, and you can't move it regardless of your money bag trail.
Well, it's tough because, I mean, the commissioner more or less is basically in place to assist the owners, and sometimes there's been a little bit of pushback from some of them throughout the years. It gets to be tough because Manfred definitely is an owner's type commissioner, so it's kind of what the owners want is kind of what happens. It just seems interesting that now how many sports we've had teams relocating to Vegas. That seems to be the hot ticket now for if you want to move a franchise. That seems to be the place to go since it just happened in the NFL a few years ago as well. It's tough with the Pirates in the 80s. The attendance had dropped off greatly. And there's always going to be a city to when they know that someone's in trouble, they're going to be more than happy to make a proposal to try get the league to switch them to their town, you know, promise them a new stadium and other stuff. So, but luckily the Pirates were able to, you know, work out the deal to get PNC Park, and that helped keep them here, which sadly was the same deal with the Penguins. They were in jeopardy of moving to, I believe, Kansas City. And then they finally worked out their new arena deal. They were the last of the three clubs to get that squared away, the Steelers and the Pirates. had their moment before them. So, but yeah, it's tough. Back in old baseball, there was decades where the same 16 teams played in the same cities for a long time. I believe the first team, if you're talking the 20th century, to move was the Boston Braves finally moved to Milwaukee. And that
right.
was like the first move. So it was a little more stability, but of course you had the American League and National League War of 1901, 1902, because in 1900 the American League was their president, Van Johnson, still considered it a minor league organization. So that was your first free agency period because National League players were courted by American League teams and they jumped. They jumped their contracts and they went and played because the American League offered more money because the National League had a maximum salary limit of $2,400 a year for a player. So,
right.
And then, of course, a peace agreement was eventually reached between the two because both leagues were pressed to pay more than they wanted to, so they finally came to an agreement. So control ended up back with ownership just with two leagues instead of one. And then the two leagues we know today have continued to exist since that peace agreement in 1903.
Well, and here's the deal to all that, you know. So they put a guy in place to make money for the owners. I understand that with Goodell and the National Football League and, you know, all these other, you know, commissioners across the thing. And there's been some great commissioners. I remember Bowie Kuhn. I remember Umaroff. I remember, you know, Giamatti. I remember Larry Stern. You know, so there's John Ziegler. There's been some great commissioners. Then there's been guys that I just scratch my head and wonder, you know, what are these guys doing? Do they know anything about the sport? So even if you bring a guy in here to stand there and say, okay, he's got unlimited money resources from all angles, from, you know, whether his, you know, aunts or uncles passed away or whatever, what kind of message is being sent to the fans that have supported that team for six, seven, eight decades? And that's where the money's coming from. So regardless of how much money you got, the bottom line is it's kind of like in football. Everybody can look at the quarterback, the running back, and the wide receiver. The game is definitely won in the trenches, the offense and defensive line. So regardless, like I said, of all these guys bringing in money and who cares where they're all coming from, and, yeah, we want to go to Vegas and everything, what message is being sent to the people that have supported this team in and out? And the same thing, we can utilize this, Ronald, is the Washington Redskins. We're asking for name changes and everything that a team's been around 87 years, not 87 days, you know, but 87 years, and we're changing things. If you're not contributing to a team, what say do you have across the board calling it derogatory? Am I right or wrong on these two fronts?
Sadly, it's a new era. I mean, it's a new era of things do change as it is. That I always try to stay away from, like, the Washington thing. I figure they can deal with that on their own. I mean, my theory is more concern should be put into the fact that the product on the field there hasn't been that good for how many years now. I mean, last year Howell, the quarterback, right? He had a few good moments early in the year, and everybody was, like, praising him, and then, of course, things started turning soft. So, it's...
But do you see
your point.
Yeah. Okay, here's the other shoe that's going to drop on this situation. So, you and I are sitting in a Pittsburgh coffee shop overlooking PNC or something, and somebody goes, well, I don't want to be associated with the Pirates or the Steelers, you know, or we got a bird movement affecting the Cardinals or the Eagles, or we got a Christian thing going with the Saints or the Cowboys or the Jets of 9/11. I mean, when does it stop to a certain extent? Because when it starts, you know, it starts to pick up steam here on that front. And the other thing is, you know, with teams moving and saying, you know what, we don't care if you've been in the city 100 years, we're going to move you. It's not right. I mean, somebody's going to take a stand on it and say, you know what, if you want to buy a team and we know you have a lot of money, you're going to keep this city in this city for 30 more years or whatever, you know, until, you know, you can actually move it. So I don't know what on those two fronts, but you're an expert and you have a lot of knowledge.
Well, I would take an example, the NCAA. the traditions of all the conferences are pretty. That's history now. I mean, did the NCAA actually put a stop to it? No, because I guess the money is going to be good. I mean, you're going to have super conferences, and those that, like you said, fans like of the 10 Pac-12, well, all those, like the UCLA tradition of basketball, they're going to be in the Big Ten, I guess, with every year, if it's next year and all that. Now the SEC is going to end up with a couple additions too. So, and I'm actually a big softball fan, even though I live in Pittsburgh. I actually follow LSU softball for some reason. I started 10 years ago. Well, Oklahoma will be going into the SEC, and Oklahoma is like the preeminent dominant team in the country.
Right.
It's a tough conference, so it'll be more interesting, but, I mean, they'll have to vibe more maybe for players, but they seem to get the job done every year because they're well-coached and they always recruit good players, or the transfer portal helps them up, bring in pieces that they need, you know, when they want to make changes. But, yeah, it's kind of tough because the tradition of the conferences in the NCAA, that's kind of shattered now. I mean, it'll be a readjustment period. I'm sure it'll be great for clashes of titanic teams against each other. But, you kind of think a bit, like, it's a shame that the tradition of, you know, when you were young and watched, like, teams play in those conferences were back then, it was the Rose Bowl was definitely, you know, the big,
the granddaddy of them all.
That's right. At 5 o'clock on New Year's Day, between the Pac-10 champion and the Big Ten champion. But it seems
well.
That
here's the thing on that.
Yeah.
Right. But Ronald, here's the thing on that. The NCAA has been a white elephant for years. It's kind of gone off a cliff. Second of all, nobody complains about, you know, the head coach or the athletic director making $20-30 million, but the poor kid that put the school on the map, and case in point, Johnny Manziel, Texas A&M, people are making money off his last name on a jersey. How fair is that? It's his last name. I mean,
they rectified a little in recent years, so at least that's
right. And Ed O'Bannon, we've talked about, you know, we've had done an interview with him, and you know, he could have been the guy that started all this with the whole thing. And how fair is that? I mean, but yeah, I'm for the portal. I'm for all this. You know, mix up the conferences. You know, you get kind of tired of USC, UCLA playing a Washington State, no interest. Now you get, you know, the Penn States and Nebraska's coming out here, or vice versa back there. I like that. But the most important thing is, if you're going to have a company, you don't take care of two people in the company, the athletic director and the head coach. You take care of everybody. So now the players got some say in this. The players are the ones that are on the field that are making money for the school. Yeah, I understand, well, I'm getting a scholarship, but if I buy the kid a hamburger or something, now I'm going on probation for 4 years. So let's throw the probations out the window. Let's make college football like the NFL, because let's face it, it's a business. You know, and that's where the kids now are starting to do it. Jim Harbaugh was no dummy. He knew Michigan's going to go on probation here. He figured, you know what, let me hightail it. Let me go to, you know, the Chargers. So, smart guy. But this is the problem. When you get all these sanctions and everything, and when you tell these kids they can't do nothing, then they're going to stand there and, you know, do other things as far as trying to make money for themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, and that's the problem. You know, what's going on? Kind of like it would almost be almost like Social Security. You can't, you know, you can only make so much money at 62 years old. Why can't you work if you want to work to make even more to better your opportunities? I don't know. Just throwing cases of point out there. Any thoughts to that?
Well, I mean, it just going like for through baseball, even through my book, the desire for the owners to maintain the control over the salaries. You know, that's something that's been going on since they started playing the game in a professional manner. I mean, in my book, Days of Reckoning, a lot of the players actually, it was salary disputes with owner Barney Dreyfus that had a hand in some of the problems. I mean, he had no problem with paying people who he felt deserved it, but if he felt that they asked for more too much and they didn't deserve it, then that's kind of where he got a little irked over that.
Let's bring that up, because that brings up an interesting point to where I'm going with this. whenever you interview baseball players, and I do a show with Kip Gross, the Gross Misconduct Podcast on Tuesdays, former Major League Baseball pitcher, 12 years, the problem is the average Joe out there stands there and thinks the ball players are making too much money, but nobody bitches about a Sylvester Stallone or a Matthew McConaughey making $20 million on a film, but they're quick to point out the athletes are making too much money. Now, my case is, if you think they're making too much money, load the family up in the old country squire, stop at a Dick's Sporting Goods, get some bats, balls, whatever you want to do, head to Arizona or Florida. If you can hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, they'll give you a big contract too. Second to that is the baseball players own baseball. Let's lay it down as far as you and I know it. They own the sport. We've known this for a long time. This union in baseball is the biggest union, much more bigger than the Teamsters union. They own the sport. I mean, we saw years ago when Artie Moreno basically told Josh Hamilton he wanted a ring on his contract, baseball players came to the forefront and they control it. So if we're going to look at a sport that, you know, the players control, and more so than any other sport, it's got to be baseball. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, baseball always has had that desire to unionize. I mean, we're talking way back. A former player named Dave Foltz, he was also a lawyer. He, on numerous occasions, attempted to unionize Major League Baseball. There was something called the Protective Players Association back in 1900. A pirate catcher named Chief Zimmer was the head of that, and they did get concessions from the owners regarding stuff. And I remember at the time, one of the key concessions was that a player could reject any trade. If you wanted to trade, like the Pirates at the time, the quirky, eccentric Rube Waddell pitched for them one season. They wanted to trade him to the Boston Bean Eaters, and he didn't want to play in Boston, so he was permitted to reject that trade. Now, that was something that didn't last long. I mean, down a few years down the road, that changed. But at least for that agreement that they came up with. But at the time, that was when the two leagues were starting their little war, so there was a lot of, like, more desire by the owners to be a little bit compliant because things were going to get tough for them to try to keep players. Because some teams, like the Phillies, lost a lot of players to the American League, many of them to Connie Mack's athletics team. So, but, yeah, I would agree that Marvin Miller at the forefront really later on, obviously, getting that where it needed to be for MLB.
Yeah, well, that was the key where I was going to go, and you beat me to the punch on it. Marvin Miller was instrumental on that, and, you know, I remember the battles with Fear and, you know, to try to – but you saw, you know, when you looked at this sport, baseball, you know, and Bud Selig tried his best to try to break the union by not having the World Series in 94, but baseball came back better than ever. And, you know, here's a guy, you know, and we'll get into your book here momentarily with about 12 minutes and some change in it, but here's a guy that I kind of think threw everybody under the bus when he claimed, you know, with the whole steroid issue. To me, Bud Selig was at the center of the problem, but instead of, you know, having, you know, his you know, portfolio fingerprinted, he threw all these other guys under the bus, Barry Bonds and Clemens and all these guys, when he was trying to resurrect the sport when it was Chicks Dig the Long Ball. Am I right or wrong?
Well, he kind of was forced into finally, I guess, doing something about it, because I believe didn't Congress start to look into it or something with hearings and stuff like that, I guess. But you kind of make a good point. It was kind of like one of them things where he was dragged kicking to the table, I guess, to finally take care of it. He's not one of my favorite commissioners, I'll just say that.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
well,
yeah.
Now get into the book, your 10th book, and boy, they keep getting better and better. Take us through, you know, a few minutes of what this thing, you know, compromises and, you know, what the average guy that's reading a book can get the knowledge and expertise out of it.
Well, the basic premise of the book, obviously, is the different players that kind of rankled management when they played here. sometimes it was legitimate, the response by ownership or management. I leave that up to the reader to decide. But some of it is, you know, Dreyfus, as an owner, he loved baseball. He loved owning a baseball team. And his goal each year was to win the pennant. And for the first decade of the 20th century, they won four. So, and they were pretty much in contention every other year. Had a little drop-off in the teens, and then again they reignited in the 20s and won two more National League flags and then won the World Series in 1925. But a lot of good players saw their careers end in Pittsburgh, but the one that I enjoyed the most covering in the book is a local kid from the Pittsburgh suburb of Dormont, a pretty good pitcher named Al Mamou. He was from a rich family. His grandfather and his father owned a tent and awning business in downtown Pittsburgh, so the family was very well off. And Al kind of, you know, when he semi-pro ball around Pittsburgh, he was a little bit spoiled, and that kind of carried over when he became a member of the Pirates. He had two 20-plus win seasons on bad Pirates teams. But he fell out of favor of management the one season in 1916 was the first time. He got suspended two seasons in a row. Basically, he was out all night. He got caught one night. He had done this on more than one occasion. He was shooting dice in the neighborhood of Pittsburgh near downtown. So they suspended him for that. And he kind of had a defiant attitude, so he ended up being traded to Brooklyn eventually. Part of the deal was Casey Stengel, who didn't really like playing here when he played here for his brief time of part of a season and part of another one, I believe. But, yeah, it's just kind of like some of the there's Hall of Famers. Like my favorite player of all time is Hazen Kai Collar, a great player, hero of the 1925 World Series. Well, he had a dispute with manager Donnie Bush in 1927, and Bush eventually benched him. And against the Yankees, that mighty Yankees murderers row team that swept the Pirates in four straight in the 27 World Series, Collar never even pinch hit. But fans at the games, even in Yankee Stadium, just clamored for when opportunities arose for him to pinch hit or even pinch run for Bush to put him in. Never used him. And, of course, then they traded him to the Cubs after that season, and he continued his Hall of Fame career in Chicago. So, yeah, it's just a look at different players and what the situations were. You know, sometimes it was salary disputes. Back then, the old adage was players being disciplined for being out of condition, which meant they were drinking too much at night when the team was on the road, usually. So some of that, like a Rabbit Moranville, who the Pirates acquired and trade from Boston. Yeah, he was a habitual drinker who eventually did reform, but a lot of crazy antics because of his carousing at night. Some interesting things. There's an interesting thing about a hotel room scene about his teammate hanging him from the 14-story window of the hotel room to go grab pigeons to pull a prank on manager Bill McKechnie. He's dangling. Moranville was a diminutive player, but yeah, dangling him from his ankles, grabbing pigeons and putting them in the closet so they flew out when McKechnie came back from the movie to change into his night clothes. So there's some good anecdotes in there too. A lot of good stories. I basically break down, you know, everything per each player. It's like in a chronological order from the time that Dreyfus gained partial control of the team in 1900 until he passed away in 1932.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun writing it too.
With less than 7 minutes, and you know, you wrote so many books. I know a guy that's done like 19. Are you trying to get to, you know, the century mark with books? I mean, because they keep getting better and better, like I alluded to before you talked about it. What is the end game on this? Because it's a nice ride to be on it with you.
Thank you. It's more of a something pops into my head as an idea, then I'm like, do I want to go with it? And usually you get excited enough about doing it. I mean, I just finished one that kind of looks at the dead ball era, which was from 1900 to 1919. Some of the more, I titled it Dead Ball Mayhem, but there's some tragic moments included in that book. Unfortunately, there was a few player suicides during that era. And, I mean, Ed Delahanty, a Hall of Fame outfielder met an untimely death by falling into the Niagara River under unusual circumstances and drowning when he was kicked off a train for causing a disturbance. And then just other stuff, like some Ty Cobb things and things like that. But right now I just started doing research on something, get back to my roots in this area. It's going to deal with dead ball era players that were born in Western Pennsylvania. And some of them are little known guys, but there's some good stories related to some of them. I've actually started doing the research, and I always enjoy when I find out stuff I didn't know as an author and a researcher. And you say, wow, I didn't know this, or wow, I didn't know this guy actually had this much of an impact on certain aspects of baseball. It's always fun, that's for sure. I always enjoy doing it whenever I start a project. So I guess the goal for me is just when you have an idea, just go with it. And if you really start to get into it, keep rolling, do the research and do the writing and see what transpires out of it.
Now, how in the last few minutes, how hard is it to put that, pen to paper thoughts for the guy that might be listening to the show that might want to write a book?
Well, for this one, I'm going to have to do all the research first, but the last few books I tried something different. When you do a biography, you have to research everything and then write. But the last few books were a little different. I actually researched each chapter and then wrote it, which was kind of good because the material was fresh in my head. But it's just a matter of I always tell anybody that says, well, what's your suggestion? Always write in your style. Don't try to copy anybody because your style is what makes an individual unique in their ability to write, and that's what makes it interesting for people to read. I mean, people don't want to read the same, the same, like everybody copying everybody else, because then it gets to be a bit too vanilla. So that's always I always say, stick to what you feel is true and write in your own style and way, and make sure you enjoy it while you're doing it. Because if you're not enjoying it, then it makes it a little tougher. So,
yeah.
But I always enjoy it, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, real fast, a nice ceremony with Jaromir Jagr last night in Pittsburgh. Unfortunately, the Penguins came up short. In 30 seconds, tell us a little about that. That must have been nice. I mean, seeing Ron Francis and Mario Lemieux and all those guys come back.
That was a great ceremony. Jaromir always was a funny guy, had a few funny comments, and it was just great because it brought back great memories from I had season tickets for those cup seasons, so it was actually phenomenal to be able to see that. Unfortunate that the Penguins didn't win the game, though. That's actually unfortunate. But great to see him.
Yeah, that came up a little short, and that was the thing. But nice to see them don those jerseys. And, Jagr, what a stellar career. I mean, he kind of went off a little when he left Pittsburgh. But the thing that stands out is what he did for the city of Pittsburgh with Lemieux. I think, seriously, they saved hockey by winning those two cups, because you and I have talked about it before, a lot of lean years in the city.
Absolutely, absolutely. Great times, though. Some of the best times.
Yeah.
Well, the Sid era is a great time, too, because there's nobody comparable to Sid. I mean, McDavid's he's becoming the star, but as far as hardworking players, Sid is where it's at. The best at being hardworking and doing what needed to be done, so... That's just my opinion as a Pittsburgher.
Yeah. Real fast, 10 seconds, Mario Lemieux or Sidney Crosby?
I can't. That's a toughie. I like to divide them into eras. I put them all in their separate category because they've actually entertained me in different eras. So, but, I mean, Mario probably had more of the talent, but Sid has the stronger work ethic, I'll say. Not that Mario was late, but, yeah, so...
Well, as we wrap this up, and boy, what an interview. We're going to do it again. We always have fun with you, brother. And I know our schedules have been not really aligned in the last couple of times, been busy and stuff. But, man, oh, man, I'm going to cherish this. And let everybody know how they can get the book again and how they can get a hold of you.
Okay. It's Dead Ball Trailblazers. I'm sorry, I'm giving the one that came out in 22. I'm sorry, Days of Reckoning, Players Punching Their Ticket Out of Pittsburgh During the Barney Dreyfus Era. That is through Sunbury Press Books, and that would be www.sunbury, S-U-N-B-U-R-Y, press.com, and that's how you can get it. It's on Amazon, too. You can buy it if you just do a search for Ronald T. Waldo, Days of Reckoning. It'll come up on Amazon as well.
Wow. Ronald P. Waldo in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. Check out the interview, the Breaking It Down podcast, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. Ronald, I'll send you the link as soon as it goes up. I love you, brother. We got to do this again.
I appreciate it, Mark. It was great talking. I always enjoy talking to you. Your knowledge of sports is without reproach, sir.
Well, God bless you. Have a wonderful one, guys. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next week.